Hello and welcome everybody to the Rise podcast. Our mission is to give you the opportunity to discover the benefits of personal development and help you to use these in a way that empowers you to improve your life. I'm Basil and I welcome you to today's fireside chat with Dr. Gary Chapman. Ready? Here we go. Thank you for joining us today for our fireside chat with Dr. Gary Chapman. Most of you told me that you already heard about him and his work. And as you know, we want to just dig a little bit deeper today in especially one of his books that's called The Five Love Languages. And for those of you who don't know it yet, it has been translated into more than 50 languages and was sold 20 million times. I'm only one of many people who can say that it greatly impacted their personal life. So yeah, Dr. Chapman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Basil. It's good to be with you and all those who are watching.
The first question that we have for you is that obviously your book, The Five Love Languages, has been incredibly successful. It has been New York Times bestseller for more than a decade and has helped thousands of people to drastically improve their relationship. Can you explain the concept of the five love languages for all of us?
Yes, the book is built on the idea and the reality that what makes one person feel loved will not necessarily make another person feel loved. And most people agree that one of our deepest emotional needs is the need to feel loved, and particularly by the people with whom we associate or closely related, whether it's family relationships or friendships or dating partners or work associates. There's that deep need to feel that people value me, people care about me, people love me. So the five languages that I discovered, and we can talk about how I discovered them later, but the five ways that I discovered that are primary in terms of the way people communicate love. One is words of affirmation, simply looking for things about the other person that you appreciate. You know, thanks for what you did. One of the things I really like about you is, it's just simply verbalizing something that you appreciate about them. You know, there's an ancient Hebrew proverb that says life and death is in the power of the tongue. We can kill people. We can give them life by the way we talk to them. And for some people, words of affirmation is their love language. This is what makes them feel loved. And if you give these people negative words or critical words, it's like a dagger in their heart, because you're taking their love language and turning it around and using it in a negative way. So words of affirmation, a second love language, and these are no particular order, but a second is acts of service, doing something for the other person that you know they would like for you to do. In a home, that would be such things as cooking meals and washing dishes and vacuuming floors and all those kind of things, and washing the car and mowing the grass. And all those are acts of service. In different relationships, of course, the acts of service would be different. In a school relationship, it might be helping a friend with a computer problem, just doing anything that you know would be helpful. You perhaps have heard the old saying, actions speak louder than words. If this is their love language, that's true. It's not true for everyone, but if acts of service is their love language, actions will speak louder than words. And then there's quality time, giving the other person your undivided attention. And I don't mean, you know, watching television together because someone else has your attention, or going to a ball game together. You know, the game has your attention. Now, if you're talking in between times and afterwards, then yeah, that becomes quality time. But the other person has your undivided attention. You're not multitasking. You're looking at them. You're listening to them. You're interfacing with them. They have your full attention. Quality time. And then there's gifts. It's universal to give and receive gifts as an expression of love. My academic background before I studied counseling was anthropology, cultural anthropology, the study of cultures. I did an undergrad and a master's. And we have discovered no cultures where gifts is not an expression of love. It's universal to give gifts. The gift says, they were thinking about me. Look what they got from me. And the gift doesn't have to be expensive. You can pick up a stone in a city parking lot and give it to an 8-year-old boy and say, hey, man, I found this today and I thought about you. Look at the colors in here. I wanted you to have it. If gifts is his love language, you'll find that stone in his dresser drawer when he's 23, and he'll remember the day you gave it to him. And then there's physical touch. In a marriage, that's such things as holding hands, kissing, embracing, the whole sexual part of marriage. In a dating relationship, it may be, you know, giving hugs, appropriate touches. There are inappropriate and appropriate touches in all human relationships. It's appropriate touches that we're talking about that communicate love. It may be a simple thing of just giving high fives to somebody or a pat on the back, you know, but affirming touches. And the basic concept is that out of those five languages, each of us, married or single, young or old, each of us has a primary love language. One of the five will speak more deeply to us emotionally than the other four. And we can receive all five. We're not going to turn away from any one of those, likely. But one of them is going to really communicate to us deeply, far more deeply than the others. It's very similar to spoken language. Every one of us grew up speaking a language with a dialect. That's the one we understand best. We call it our native tongue. I grew up speaking English, Southeastern style, okay? I live in North Carolina. But everybody grew up speaking a language with a dialect, and that's their native tongue. So everybody has a love language. So if we want to communicate love effectively on an emotional level, we must learn the other person's love language and express love on a regular basis in their primary language. So that's the basic concept.
Thanks so much for explaining the concept. And you already touched upon discovery. So can you talk a little bit more about how you discovered the five love languages and why do you think it has been so successful?
Yeah, I discovered it in my counseling. I have been doing marriage and family counseling for 35, almost 40 years now. And I'll never forget many, many years ago, the first time it dawned on me that what makes one person feel loved doesn't make another person feel loved. It was a married couple who came in. I'd never met them. And they sat down and the wife said, well, Gary, let me just tell you some things about us before we start. She said, we've been married 30 years. And she said, we don't argue. We don't have any money problems. And she went on with two or three more positive things. I was beginning to wonder, did they come in here to tell me what a good marriage they have? But then she started crying and she said, but the problem is, I don't feel any love coming from him. We're like roommates living in the same house. He does his thing. I do my thing. There's nothing going on between us. And she said, I feel so empty inside and I don't know how long I can go on like this. Well, I look back at him and he said, I don't understand her. I do everything I can to show her that I love her. I said, well, what do you do to show your love? He said, well, I get home from work before she does. So I start the evening meal. Sometimes I actually have it ready when she gets home. If not, she'll help me. And then we eat together. After we eat, he said, I wash the dishes. Every Thursday night, I vacuum the floors. Every Saturday, I wash the car. I mow the grass. I help her with the laundry. And he went on. I was beginning to wonder, what does this woman do? It sounded to me like he was doing everything. He said, I do all of that. And she says she doesn't feel loved. He said, I don't know what else to do. I look back at her and she said, he's right. He's a hardworking man. And then she started crying and she said, but we don't ever talk. We haven't talked in 20 years. He's always mowing the grass, washing the dishes, vacuuming the floor, always doing something. So I knew here was a sincere husband. He was loving his wife in the best way he knew how, and the wife did not feel loved. So I realized, you know, that there was a difference in the way people perceive love. So that's where it all started. And I heard similar stories over and over again in my counseling office. And so eventually I thought, you know, there's got to be a pattern to this. So I took time and sat down and read several years of notes that I made when I was counseling and asked myself the question, when someone said, I feel like my spouse doesn't love me, what did they want? What were they complaining about? And their answers fell into five categories. And I later called them the five love languages. And I started using it in my counseling. that if you want her to feel love, you've got to express love in her language. If you want him to feel love, you've got to express love in his language. I would help them discover each other's language, challenge them to go home and try it. And sometimes they would come back in 3 weeks and say, Gary, this is changing everything. The whole climate's different now between us. And then I started using it with small groups of couples. And the same thing would happen. Probably 5 years later, I thought, you know, if I could put this concept in a book, write it in the language of the common person, leave out all the psychological jargon, maybe I could help a lot of couples that I would never have time to see in my office. Of course, little did I know that what you said earlier is true. It's sold now over 20 million copies and been published in over 50 languages around the world. You know, so I think that demonstrates the fact that it's meeting a deep need and it's helping people learn how to communicate love effectively, you know, on a deep level. So I discovered it in the marriage relationship, but quickly realized it applies to children as well. So to parents, I say, the question is not, do you love your children? The question is, do your children feel love? I often give the story of a 13-year-old young man who had run away from home, and he ended up in my office. And he said to me, my parents don't love me. They love my brother, but they don't love me. I knew his parents. I knew they loved him. The problem is they had never learned to express love in his love language. So this has helped a lot of parents, you know, connect emotionally with their children. And if children feel loved, then they grow up emotionally healthy. If they don't feel loved, they grow up with internal emotional struggles. And the teenage years, they will often go looking for love, many times in the wrong place. So it has relationships. Later, I did write the five love languages of children, same five languages. Then I wrote the five love languages of teenagers, because in the teenage years, things change a bit. It's not that their love language changes, but you have to use different dialects of that language, because what you've been doing, they consider childish, but they still have the same love language. So, and then later I wrote a singles edition, five love languages, singles edition for single adults. And I applied the concept in all of their relationships to their parents, their siblings, their college roommates, their dating partners, their work associates, because this applies in all close human relationships. We want to express love. We want to express that we care for them, but often we miss them because we don't have this information.
Wow. And you said that it transferred so many marriages. So one thing that you mentioned that you helped people to do is discover their own love language. So for us listening, do you have some advice how we can, or some easy things we can do to discover our own love language?
Now, here are three informal ways. One is you ask yourself, how do I naturally respond to other people? If, for example, I'm always giving people affirming or encouraging words of affirmation is probably my language, because we tend to speak our own language. If I'm always giving people high fives and little taps on the back, probably physical touch is my language. If I'm a gift giver, that is, I just regularly am giving people gifts, then that's probably my primary language. If I really enjoy sitting down with a friend and just having an hour and a half lunch and just discussing life together, quality time is probably my language. So take a look at yourself and ask, how do I naturally communicate to other people that I care about? But secondly, what do I complain about most often? The complaint reveals the love language. If you're saying to a friend, I just feel like we don't spend enough time together. We're both so busy. You're complaining about not getting quality time. In fact, I had a mother say to me the other day, she said, Dr. Chapman, my 6-year-old son said to me, we don't ever go to the park anymore since the baby came. He and his mother used to have quality time. He had her undivided attention. Now the baby's here and he's complaining about it. So what do you complain about most often? And it may be different with different people, but what do you complain about most often? Because your complaint will reveal the love language. And then what do you request of other people most often? And when my daughter was in the teenage years, she would say to me often, "Dad, can we take a walk after dinner?" She wanted quality time. She wanted the two of us to be together so we could talk, you know, walking down the road, walking through the community. She was asking me for quality time. My son would say most often, "Dad, can we play basketball in the backyard?" And the way we played basketball, it was physical touch because we ran into each other, hit each other, you know. So what do you request, you know, of other people most often? If you look back on your childhood, your teenage years, your friends at college or whatever, you do those three things. Chances are you can figure out what your love language is. Now, I'll give you a more formal way. There's a free quiz at 5lovelanguages.com. That's the number 5, 5lovelanguages.com. There's a quiz for married couples. There's a quiz for single adults. There's a quiz for teenagers. And there's a quiz, I don't think there's a quiz for children, but there's some questions you can ask children to try to decide their language. And let me just throw this out. You can discover a child's love language, at least by the time they're 4 years old, by doing what? Number one, observing their behavior. When my son was that age and I would come home from work, he would run to the door, grab my legs and climb on me. He's touching me because he wants to be touched. Our daughter never did that. At that age, she would say, "Daddy, come into my room. I want to show you something." She wanted quality time, my undivided attention. So it's there very early in a child's life, at least by four. It could be even younger. And it tends to stay with us, you know, throughout a lifetime.
So if we actually discover our own love language, then, as you already mentioned, we're trying to take the next step to learn to speak somebody else's, maybe our partner's love language, which can be even more difficult. Is there anything we can do to make that process any easier?
I think basically those same three things. If you're around them a lot, observe how they relate to people. Do you hear them giving encouraging words to people? If you happen to hear them on the phone, do they give encouraging words to people? Again, see, that's whatever they're doing is most naturally and most often is a clue to what their love language is. So observe their behavior. And then what do they complain about most often? Again, their complaint will reveal the love language. If a spouse, for example, in a marriage says, "I just feel like, you know, we don't spend time together anymore. I feel like we're ships passing in the night," you know, and sometimes a husband will get defensive if a wife says that. He'll say, "What do you mean don't spend time together? We had dinner Thursday night," you know, but she's saying, "We don't have any sit down and listen time. We don't have any time when we're really, really having face-to-face, heart-to-heart conversations." So she's complaining about it. So what do your friends complain about most often? And then what do they request most often? If they're always inviting people to go to lunch and they want to sit down at lunch and talk to people, that's probably their language is quality time. That's what they're asking people to do with them. So I think you put those same three things together. And obviously, if they're a close friend or a family member, you can also encourage them to go to the website, take the free quiz. They told me recently, because that website's run by my publisher, they said 60 million people have taken that the quiz for couples alone. So I told them, I said, "You guys should have been charging $1 a piece. You know, they said, no, we're just trying to help people get the concept. So, yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it makes sense. And you already touched upon how we can kind of include the concept, for example, if we're not in a relationship or maybe even in other areas of life, which can be like in a sports team. Or like you mentioned, in family relationships. So would the concept itself still stay the same, or is there any major differences when I'm not in a relationship, but still trying to like apply the 5 love languages to my teammates or maybe to my friends or colleagues?
I think the same principle applies. Obviously, the closer the relationship, the more likely you are to be able to figure out what their love language is. If you don't spend much time with them, it's just, you know, you see them now and again, you may not be able to figure that out. Here's another place that becomes very helpful. That is, if a young adult has a fractured relationship with their parents because of things that have happened, and they likely have the sense, my parents don't really love me. This can help them. I'll just give you an example. I was lecturing in a prison. It was one of the largest prisons in the country. Every man in there was in there for life. And it was an open meeting. We had about 300 men that showed up. And I said, I want to try to explain to you why you either felt love growing up or you did not feel love growing up. And I explained the love languages in that context. And when the Q&A came, one young man stood up and said, I want to thank you for coming. Because for the first time in my life, I finally understand my mother loves me. He said, you gave those five languages, and I knew that my love language was physical touch. But my mother never hugged me. He said, the only hug I ever remember getting from my mother was the day I went to prison. But you gave those other languages, and I realized my mother spoke acts of service. She was a single mom. She had two jobs. She kept food on the table. She kept clothes on my back. He went on just naming the thing. And by this time, he was crying. And I started crying. And he ended up by saying, Mama loves me. Mama loves me. Mama loves me. So you see, understanding this concept, he can look back and see that his mother was loving him. It just wasn't in his language, but she was loving him. And now he can give her credit for it. And often there can be a reunion and a reconciliation of where there's been a broken relationship when you understand this.
Wow, that's such a powerful story. And you also already mentioned that you have been counseling couples and helping to improve their relationships for decades. Is there maybe like one or two pieces of advice that you think anyone needs to hear when it comes to building and sustaining a healthy relationship?
You know, I like to think that there are two essentials to having long-term healthy relationships, whether it's a friendship, whether it's a marriage, whether it's a work relationship or whatever, two essentials. One is what we've just been talking about, and that is we keep love alive in the relationship. We learn how to communicate love. We meet the deep emotional need that each of us have to be loved. But the second is that we have to learn how to deal effectively with our failures. Now, the reason I say this is an essential is because none of us are perfect. I don't care what the relationship, there's going to be times that we will fail each other. We either will say things that are hurtful, or we will fail to say things that should have been said. We'll do things that are hurtful or fail to do things, and we hurt the other person. Sometimes not intentionally, sometimes intentionally. We're in anger and we just lash out at them. So none of us are perfect. You don't have to be perfect to have long-term healthy relationships, but you do have to deal with your failures. And this means learning how to apologize and choosing to forgive when people are apologizing to us. And this, again, is kind of a tricky area because we have different ideas on what a sincere apology looks like. You know, normally what we're asking, if someone is apologizing, we're asking, are they sincere? In our mind, we're asking, are they sincere? But we judge sincerity by how they verbalize their apology. And what we discovered, and I wrote a book on this called When Sorry Isn't Enough. And I wrote it with another counselor because she had the idea. She said, you know, Gary, I've been using the love languages for years in my counseling, but I think people also have apology languages. I said, what do you mean? She said, I think people have a different idea about what a sincere apology looks like. And as soon as she said it, I resonated with it because I've had them in my office for years arguing over whether or not one of them apologized. She would say, for example, I would forgive him if he would just apologize. And he would say, I did apologize. You didn't apologize. I told you I was sorry. That's not an apology. So they're arguing over whether or not he apologized. So I said to her, let's do some research. And if this is true, then we'll write a book together. And we asked thousands of people all over the country two questions. When you apologize, what do you typically say or do? Second question, when someone's apologizing to you, what do you want to hear them say and do? And their answers fell into five categories. And I promise you, we weren't looking for five. I like five, but we weren't looking for five. And we later called them the five languages of apology. And we started sharing this in our workshops and things that we each do. We don't do them together. We do them individually. But you say typically we learn how to apologize from our parents. Little Johnny pushes his sister. His mother says, "Johnny, you don't do that to sister. Go tell her you're sorry." So little Johnny says, "I'm sorry," even if he's not. "I'm sorry." He's 23 now. What's he going to say if he's apologizing? "I'm sorry." But other people had other parents who taught them other things. And so I'll just list them for you real quickly without going into them. One of them is expressing regret, often with the words, "I'm sorry." But don't ever just say, "I'm sorry." Tell them what you're sorry for. And what you're saying by, "I'm sorry, I feel badly that what I did has hurt you and hurt our relationship. You regret what happened." And then another is accepting responsibility. "I was wrong. Should not have done that. No excuse for that. I take full responsibility." And for some people, this is what they're waiting to hear. And if you don't accept responsibility, they're going to say, "Yeah, he says he's sorry, but he wanted to acknowledge that he was wrong." You know, and then there's offering to make restitution. "What can I do to make this right? I know I've hurt you deeply. I've hurt our relationship. And I'm very sorry about that, but what can I do to make it right?" And if this is their language, they'll have an idea on what you can do. And when you do it, they sense your sincerity. And then the other is, I sometimes forget the exact terminology that we use, but it's expressing the desire to change your behavior. Expressing the desire to change your behavior. It's saying, not only "I'm sorry, you know I hurt you deeply," but it's saying, "I don't ever want to do that again. Can we talk? Can you help me? Can I get a plan so I will not do that again?" Because see, so many times, especially in a close relationship like marriage, we do something, we apologize, we say we're sorry, they forgive us. Next month, we do the same thing again. We say, "I'm sorry," they forgive us. About three or four of these, and they're going to be saying, they're going to be saying, "How could you be sincere? How could you be sorry when you don't make any changes?" So for some, it's that making of changes. And then the last one is actually requesting forgiveness. "Will you forgive me? I hope that you can find it in your heart to forgive me." So those are the five languages we discovered. And it's not quite as strong that it's only one of those. It might be two of those, you know, for a couple. But if we understand that concept, it will help us when it comes time to apologize. And if it's a close relationship like a marriage, you can discuss this beforehand and find out what each other, you know, what they consider to be a sincere apology. So, but to me, these are the two essentials. It's meeting each other's need for emotional love, and it's dealing effectively with our failures. Now, the apology is not enough. There has to be a response. And the healthy response is forgiveness, which means I'm going to pardon you. I'm not going to make you pay for this for the next 20 years. And I'm going to remove the barrier, the emotional barrier that this created between us. I'm going to remove it so that our relationship can go forward. And so when we do that, now we move on and the relationship can continue to grow.
Wow, I actually never heard of that concept. So it sounds super interesting as well. And I think we do have a few questions from some of the students.
Okay.
My name is Eugene Takahashi. I'm a freshman at Menlo College. And I was just curious about like the biological aspect of love languages. Would you say the love languages are like genetically predisposed to like your father having it or your mother having it and you having the same type of love?
You know, it's a good question. And be honest, I don't have a good answer. Oh. I'm often asked that question. I don't know, you know, if it's genetic or it's learned very early. I do know it's there very early in a child's life, just like a lot of other things are there very early in a child's life. You know, some children, for example, little children, I mean, three-year-olds will be organized. All their toys are in order, and others just throw them in the box. So there are some personality traits that are there very early, but whether it's a nature or nurture, I really don't know. I just know it's there early.
We have a personal question. What is your love languages?
Oh, my love language is words of affirmation And my wife's love language is acts of service. I didn't know that when we got married. So what did I do when I got married? I gave her words of affirmation because that's my love language. And I told her how nice she looked, how much I appreciate what she did. I probably told her a dozen times a day, I love you, honey. I am so glad I married you. I love you, love you, love you. And one night she said to me, you keep on saying I love you. If you love me, why don't you help me? And I said, what do you mean? She said, well, you don't ever offer to help with the dishes, or you don't ever clean the toilet. You don't ever vacuum the floor. And in my mind, I'm thinking, that's what my mother did. I thought you were going to do that. I didn't say that, but that's what I thought. But looking back on that, she was telling me her love language was acts of service. I didn't know enough to pick up on it, but I did start helping her. And when I started helping her, she started giving me some positive words. So even though we didn't know the concept, we stumbled on to the reality that, words made me feel appreciated and acts of service made her feel appreciated. So I still wash the dishes. I still vacuum the floors. I still take out the trash. Okay. And she tells me I'm the greatest husband in the world. And I know that's hyperbole, but it still feels good.
It sounds like one of the biggest challenges is once you know the other person's love language, to actually make effort to speak it, right? Because it doesn't come to you naturally.
Yes. And if it's one that you, let's say you did not receive when you were a child yourself, it's difficult. But here's the good news. You can learn to speak any of these languages, even if you did not receive them as a child, because they're all doable. Now, obviously, you have to have the attitude. You have to make the choice. Yes, I'm going to, if that's her language or his language, then I'm going to learn how to do that. But you can learn any one of them. But yes, if their number one is your number five, that is, it doesn't mean much to you, you'll have to put you up some post-it notes, keep it on the front burner to remember what it is until you learn to do it.
Okay, I think we have one last question.
Hi, Dr. Chapman. Thank you for joining me. My name is Bianca. One of the things that I was wondering is, I understand we have our primary love language. Does that shift in different areas of life? Like perhaps you have one primary love language in relationships, like love relationships, partnerships, and relationships versus with your family versus with your friends. Can that express itself in different ways? Or is it the same across the board?
I think the love language, the primary love language, tends to stay with us for a lifetime, like many other personality traits. However, there are situations, which you alluded to, there are situations where another love language may jump to the top for a period of time or in a certain circumstance. I'll give you an example. A mother who has two preschool children at home, acts of service may not be her primary language, but during those years, it's probably going to jump to the top, because she's overwhelmed with trying to take care of these two children. So it probably will become acts of service during that time. So I think that's just an illustration. But yes, I think there are certain situations, certain circumstances where another love language may jump to the top, for a brief time or maybe for a longer time, depending on the situation. But I think all other things being equal, it does tend to stay with us for a lifetime. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Chapman.
Well, it's good to join you, Anna. It's great that you're doing this, and good to see all of you in different places around the world. And here's the thing really that surprised me about the love languages, and that is it went to other cultures. Because of my background in cultural anthropology, I thought, I don't know, does this work in other cultures? But every time the publisher in those countries were asking for it, so my publisher sold them the rights, and it's done well in various cultures around the world. But what you're doing in terms of the Fireside Chat, let me encourage you. I think it's wonderful that you're doing this together and inviting people with different perspectives to come in and speak to you. So.
Thank you for listening to this podcast episode with Dr. Gary Chapman. If you want to get more content from Rise, check out our Instagram at Rise Club Menlo. We hope you enjoyed this fireside chat and that the concept of the five love languages will help you to improve the quality of your life. Let's keep rising.